bless you for being an angel. Just when it seemed that heaven was not for me.
Hello and welcome to Drunk Church. I'm Cosima B. Concordia.
And I'm Aurora Layborn.
Today we're going to do an episode on bimbo theory. So that's long been the handle of my online presence. And initially, I don't think that there was a lot of thought put into it. I think it was that I was participating in these like larger theory discourses around queerness, and bimbo was a sort of fun way to take the seriousness off of it and be a little bit more playful in like the hyper femininity of it.
It's funny you say there wasn't a lot of thought, because that's, I think, the argument that we're going to make is that the lack of thought is actually indicative of a ton of thought.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And that I think one of the things in academia that is very obvious for anyone that is there from is that a huge amount of it is built on making it inaccessible and not actually engaging with the communities that are actually on the ground doing the thing. So lots of the time, by the time it enters the academy, probably people within like sub-communities, especially when we're talking about like queerness, have been thinking about these things for a really long time and actually like putting them into practice. So by the time they make it into the academy, they often have been needlessly complicated and also simultaneously sanitized. And obviously mm-hmm. that's not always true, but like there
it's mostly true.
Yes, it is largely true, but there are exceptions, but that is kind of like the process of the academy. And I think that a large amount of our listeners here are either folks that are like currently in academia or like academic dropouts who are doing other things with their lives. In our podcast, like Drunk Church, you know, it's a project that very much seeks to exist outside of any sort of academic institution. We aren't interested in that sort of allegiance. Aurora is, you know, actively going to get her PhD soon and like teaches classes, but that those worlds are like very separate for us, and that the way that we engage with thinkers and people in our community kind of necessitates us being very careful.
We are anti-establishment.
Yeah, anti-establishment. The people we engage with, like, we're never talking about someone's work because of their like academic credentials. We're talking about their work because we find their work really interesting and worthwhile for the things that we're talking about.
The people whose work we engage with, they're also active critics of the academy. Like, the work that they're doing exposes how it, again, like sanitizes this radical language and just uses it to like pathologize people, or uses it to like create like an unproductive hatred of sex, or uses it to further like transmisogynistic practices of psychoanalysis, like to talk about Avgi's most recent work. So we engage with the critics, or we can talk about Jules' new work that critiques how liberal feminism like threw trans women under the bus. And that's all a critique of mm-hmm. institutions.
Like, by bimbo theory, I think lots of the time I'll get feedback from people that I am being overly complex and that what we're talking about is hard. And I think that there is a distinction to be drawn towards making things needlessly opaque so that they're less accessible to outsiders mm-hmm. versus actually engaging with thought in ways that are inherently difficult. Like, the reality is that to think through something is difficult. To think about something in a deep way requires actual work, and it's not like a passive process. And at the same time, we don't want to participate in the kind of Instagramification. Well, I mean, I absolutely participate in this, but where everything becomes an infographic, right? Where everything becomes this thing that you can reduce down to these bare parts, and then pretending that those things are sufficient to our overall engagement with that thing.
Yeah. So you just have to like it and look at it, and then it's done, versus wrestle with it or think about it at all.
Mm-hmm, exactly. The figure of the bimbo has been very interesting within, I think like our last maybe like 10 years in like popular culture, which I think initially very much like kind of arose within like fetishism, like bimbofication, forms of kink that's about a performance of hyperfemininity and a letting go of the veneer of like having to be smart, and that that act in itself can be like a very clever, calculated thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really funny now, because I think it's like quite common now for like people with PhDs to, you know, like call themselves bimbos and like tweets or whatever. It really connects strongly to this hyper performance of femininity that we see coming out of traditions like sex work, largely from like trans women, you know, like the dolls, the performance of that for survival. And so I think that those things can't be disentangled from each other. I've talked about like gender maximalism. One of my biggest pet peeves about a lot of the way that queerness has infiltrated mainstream discourse is that there's this big attraction to androgyny, where basically like a haircut is really gender transgressive, right? Whereas I think if you look at like mostly sex worker communities, trans communities, performance of gender is maximalist instead of minimalist. And mm-hmm. So it's throwing away this kind of like sock aesthetic of abandoning the aesthetics and the hyper erotics of gender, and instead really like leaning into that. And so that doesn't necessarily mean binariness, being transsexual is not binary, but also it doesn't necessarily mean like all femininity or more or all masculinity, but just performances of extreme gender presentation, I think, mm-hmm. Have always been very interesting to me. And it's very much how I like sort my erotics. I find gender very attractive. I find performance very attractive. I'm much more attracted to women than men generally. But if I would to say like, what is the most attractive man? I would say like a leather daddy bear, you know, that like has a belly, like hairy, like, you know, really leaning into those erotics of gender. And I think that there's this real attempt in queerness to sanitize and to like lean away from gender. Like gender is this thing that the straights do. And mm-hmm. So we're going to be in this kind of ambiguous middle. And like, I actually like highly gendered individuals. I like being treated in a gendered way. And like the queer spaces that I feel like most at home are ones where like gender is always highly at play. It's always a performance that is like going on with me and my friends and, you know, partners, mm-hmm. and is never something that is just like dismissed as this kind of unimportant accoutrement, I guess.
Can we talk a little bit about minimalism? Because I feel like we've been sold minimalist aesthetics, or that's been seen as like a political ideal. And I don't know how they managed to do that, because I think minimalism and that kind of that sleekness, it leads to like the ugly Tesla truck, or it ends up devaluing and seeing as frivolous any kind of pleasure from like the accoutrements of gender. There's just no playfulness. It's austere. It is like very, oh my goodness, it's austere, it's efficient, it's actually like becoming docile. Like we critique femininity, especially of, well, it actually limits women's mobility, or it's evidence of women only appearing for the male gaze, for male pleasure. Women end up like doing all these intense things to their body that is just disciplining the body, like ripping their hairs from the follicle and like painting their long nails so that they can't use their hands, when actually it seems like minimalist approaches and minimalist aesthetics is the thing that's making us better, more productive citizens if we're not quote unquote wasting our time. And there was, mm-hmm. I don't know, there's a sleight of hand happening there where we're told, oh, to be yet transgressive is to be like as minimalist as possible. And yet that seems to be the thing that is just prepping us into being the obedient, uninteresting little model citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
I don't know. I hate minimalism. It was really something that was sold to us as, yeah, we're going to be better, more productive. And
yeah, and it's also rich people aesthetics, a level of respectability because you're like distancing yourself from the necessity of performing gender, but also like minimalism in the sense of like minimalism in your life or in your home, that like, oh, I don't need many things because I can buy whatever I need whenever I want it, as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, generally people that like hoard or have a lot of things. You know, you have things because you need things and you want to have access to those things, and you don't necessarily just have the unlimited resources to have like big hallowed halls.
Yeah, my little studio apartment is crammed full of clutter, and a lot of the clutter is things like half realized projects or things that I don't know if I might need them again. Like, so I don't know why, again, we were sold a vision of gender as uncluttered. Or
as I've gotten older, I've gotten better, well, and medicated. As I've gotten better, older and medicated, I have gotten better at not living within clutter, but I always live within maximalism. I always have a maximalist aesthetic. There's always a lot of stuff because stuff has meanings, books, little trinkets, like all of it has connections to the things I do in my life, the people in my life. The kind of minimalist aesthetic I also think is a kind of fetishization of a type of masculinity and a rejection of femininity. The very regressive idea that second wave feminism often speaks as truth, that femininity is always just this like performance and is something that is inherently fake and like not meaningful, and that like you're just performing for, you know, your man or whatever. Whereas like masculinity is the lack of performance. Masculinity is just being what, like, whatever the fuck you want, and like, you know, going out in the rugged world to do action and instead of performance. And so then every woman, like all of these women in like these like quote unquote feminist spaces in like STEM or in academia, you know, there's just this pressure to not perform femininity, to be taken seriously, right? Which is such a regressive turn. I think masculinity is great when masculinity also does something. That's the great thing about like, you know, what we can see with like queer leathermen or just that there's like actual aesthetics happening. And that, like, one of the reasons that, like, often, like, men are so boring to look at is because they're not performing anything. Or the thing that they're performing depends on them not performing it, if that makes sense. Like, the version of masculinity that they're doing depends on not caring about the masculinity. To care too much would be to veer too close to, you know, the gay. Contemporary like straight performance of masculinity is a performance of not performance, a performance of not caring, and that's why, like, why masculinity is often so boring and bad. To perform too much would be to approach queerness, which is why, you know, we had such thing as like metrosexual, you know, in the 90s, where just to like care about your appearance at all was inherently to, you know, be like a little gay. To wipe your ass, right, is to be a little fruity with it, I guess. The institutions that we take the most seriously, women are put into this double bind where there's this expectation, of course, there's still sexism around appearance, but the performance of femininity has to be like a femininity that isn't performing too much, because that would be frivolous and against seriousness.
Bimbo as critique of seriousness, as critique of reason. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between maximalism and pleasure. So this account of masculinity, for example, the masculinist or the maximalist masculinity seems to be bound up in pleasure versus a traditional masculinity, which is like austere and bound up in, I can't even think about the things that men do that just seem awful. Like playing football seems like the least pleasurable thing in the world. But maximal gender maximization, my tongue is totally tied, and femininity. So yeah, where does pleasure stand, and what does pleasure do there?
Yeah, I don't know, that's a hard question. How about you first talk a little bit about your experience in academia as somewhat of a high femme?
I love that I'm only somewhat of a high femme, because that's actually literally true. I'm femme, but like I'm not even the highest femme, and I still have to put up with so much bullshit.
Yeah, you're high femme on occasion, but you've probably taken it down a notch at times because of the academy.
Yeah, I've actually, now that I'm teaching philosophy of sex and gender, and I'm more in the WGSS department, they keep changing the name, which is awesome. But I'm like, okay, great, I can wear my weird shit and I don't have to worry about it. But I also teach biomedical ethics, and I'm, again, around a ton of STEM people, and I notice that they do treat me differently depending on what I'm wearing. But the thing about the femme phobia in the academy is that there's always something else happening. So we critique femininity, again, as being frivolous, unserious, as being evidence of a woman's internalization of the oppression of the patriarchal gaze. We see it as evidence that she's spending too much time worrying about what other people think about how she looks versus what she says, so thus maybe we shouldn't listen to what she has to say. But at the same time, women are also, like, in the academy, not allowed to assert themselves in certain ways. So I still have to use a million qualifiers when I want to say something, and I still have to wait to make sure that someone likes me enough to listen to what I have to say. Otherwise, I can count on them intentionally mishearing me. I still have to, like, sometimes wait until a better respected man or a better respected woman makes half of the same point that I've already made, and then I can compliment their point and then get my point in, you know? It's like playing chess in a million dimensions.
It's been really interesting for me the entire time, because, like, you've stayed in academia most of the time since we were
since we've known each other.
Uh-huh. Yeah, since we have known each other. And that entire time, you have, like, told me all the ins and outs of everything that's happening. And so much of it is horrifying. Academia is bad. like such a regressive fucking institution. Just the amount of, like, misogyny and, like, slut shaming. I don't know. It's really gross. And I think a lot of it can come down to homophobia, but in the way that, like, people can convince themselves they're not homophobic because they've just kind of sublimated those things into being overly sexual or, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like, oh, well, I don't care about the gays that, like, don't talk about their gayness, like, aren't too gay. Like,
yeah. I'm going to be polemic, and we've talked a little bit about this off mic, but the thing that is so mind-blowing to me is it's not just the men that are sexist and awful about the femme phobia, because they also kind of like it. They like the feminine pretty woman. They just use that as an excuse to not listen to women. And they can feel good about themselves by not listening to the bimbo, because a real feminist wouldn't dress like that. That sucks, but I can understand it like that. It sucks when, like, a second wave dyke is, like, a little shitty to me as a high femme. But, like, I can also kind of understand that. Like, it's like, okay, you are a product of your time. I'm just thankful that you're not transphobic.
But the thing is that they, like, don't have to be that way. Like, there's so many older dykes who think high femmes are hot, you know? I don't know.
So, like,
you
I can
have to be this way.
Even, like, a younger dyke, like, I can get that. It's like, okay, that is your Weltanschauung.
I don't think I could excuse anyone under 50. Yeah. Fuck that.
Like, well, I can, if it's a younger dyke who just recently was exposed to some Marxist feminism, and I mean younger, so I mean, like, they're, like, still basically a teenager, and they're, like, really seduced by this, like, super powerful language, and they feel like they're part of something. They get, like, a 6-month period to figure that out.
We can give them space, but it, you know, that's fine.
Okay. Like, the thing that I, like, cannot handle is I cannot handle the straight women. And it's always the straight women, and, like, we were talking about this, and I'm just gonna be polemic. It's always the ones that, like, kind of wish that they were gay but aren't, mm-hmm. that are just the biggest fucking assholes about femphobia. Like, they're so nasty. So that's in the humanities. Like, in the sciences, it's the ones that are having to grapple with showing their peers that they're the serious one because they're the least feminine, and then they're just shitty to other women. But I cannot handle the amount of, like, backhanded bullshit I have to deal with straight women that are somewhat self-loathing because they're not lesbians, but they obviously don't really like other women, and they feel like they're, like, personally harmed by the fact that they're straight, but then they also feel like they're personally harmed by every other woman's relationship with any kind of traditional femininity, despite the fact that they're the ones living the most traditional lifestyle. They're the ones that want the most traditional lifestyle. Like, oh, I wish I was a lesbian.
yeah. But I found my life partner, and like now we're building a life, and I have to like listen to their bullshit. Like I've had to listen to them complain about like not making enough money to buy a house while they make like millions of times more than I do. And like honestly, we're all underpaid. But dude, you don't get to be a femphobic asshole to me and then bitch about how you wish you were straight and then complain, or you wish that you were not straight and then complain about not getting all of the benefits of your straightness. Like, what is your problem?
Yeah.
My experience like recently doing some like medical ethics is I'm hanging out on these committees with a ton of women doctors, which is cool, slay. A lot of them are OBGYNs or do fertility stuff, and they're just like the biggest judgmental assholes about anything that is non-normative, but then they can justify it by being so aggressively non-feminine, even though they're very traditionally feminine women. They're just not wearing makeup or not wearing sexy clothes, but like they have, again, like the biggest fucking rocks on their fingers, and they're like bitching about non-monogamy, or like they don't want to help this young trans boy freeze his eggs, and they're justifying it. And it's just like, you've done feminism wrong if all you're doing is cherry picking the things that help you get ahead, and then you're just punching down the entire way.
Absolutely. And I mean, like the root of trans misogyny, a lot of it is femphobia. Like the whole reason trans women are so reviled is like the idea that anyone would want to be a woman, would want to leave, you know, quote unquote masculinity. Not that I ever had masculinity, but like the idea of having that thing and then taking, you know, like womanhood is absurd in our context. And especially like that a lot of trans women tend to perform maximalist performances of gender, you know, not all of us, but a lot of us. I think that that certainly like helps with the revulsion. And of course, it's always like, as womanhood is a double bind in general, trans womanhood even more so, where if you are performing womanhood too much, then it's like, oh, it's like, it's just a fetish. You're just like, you think womanhood is a costume. But if you're not performing it enough, then it's like, you're not actually properly a woman because you're not doing the correct things. And so, like always, it's just kind of getting the worst end of the stick on every level.
A lot of people will justify their femphobia with second wave feminism, but I've been revisiting a lot of that for this class that I'm teaching. And even people like Isis Marie Young and Beauvoir and Bartke, they're critical of the oppression that people like experience like, as a result of feminine comportment, which is what they'll call it. So like womanhood is already a really ambiguous, fluid category, but they're not blaming the women. They're not blaming the people that are subject to. They're trying to understand how this oppression operates, and it operates through a devaluation of the feminine. And they're articulating that. And then sometimes people just pick that up and they run with it, and they're like, okay, well then the thing to do is just to be as unfeminine as possible. And it just, it's a misreading of those works. Okay, so if the point of so much feminism is to expose the double binds, and that's, again, what so much second wave feminism talking about aesthetics and femininity is doing, it's like the double bind of femininity and of womanhood. It's that there's no right way to be a good woman, is that good woman is an impossible thing. We're given these scripts. We're given scripts like the pleasing woman, the together woman, the girl boss, but you can't be any of those things. Like, it's impossible. And so to read that work and to be like, whoa, femininity, it's like, yeah, you are like just internalizing the patriarchy. Like, to get that insight from those texts and be like, and to tell yourself, well, I'm going to be the good woman because I'm going to wear the appropriate amount of makeup, and I'm going to have the appropriate cadence to my voice and to my movement, and I'm going to make sure that I show only a little bit of leg and the right amount of cleavage, but never too much leg and too much cleavage at the same amount of time. Like, that's just stupid. It's so stupid.
Yeah. Well, and like to
read
think
a
about,
book,
like the reasons. Yeah. For real. The reasons that I perform femininity in the ways that I do, like a large amount of it is a survival mechanism. Like, I do perform, not for men, but just for people in general, when I like leave the house, because it gets me treated better in some basic ways. Like now I am luckily at the point in my transition where I'm not really clocked. And for the most part, like I'm never misgendered by strangers, really, no matter what. But especially like at the beginning, it was just a basic way of survival and like protecting against like hate crimes as much as I could at that time. Also just like as a queer woman, like trying to get some amount of respect and that I have experienced, you know, like violence in public. And that is something that I would like to not experience. And obviously, then the performance of femininity also makes you vulnerable to sexual assault and a whole other set of things. But the people that I am performing femininity for, like on a personal level, are not ever straight men, right? Mm-hmm. They're mostly dykes in my life, like some trans masks, but like it's within this like very different erotic milieu. And like these performances of femininity are very, very different from straight performances of femininity. And they have like very different contexts. And like to be a femme, to be clear, no straight woman is a femme. Like femme and butch are very specifically queer terms with like queer erotics to them and queer relations. And we're doing something different.
Just to piggyback off that, there's a certain cruelty to the femme phobia that other, again, mostly straight women in my experience are guilty of, because in so many cases, like femininity and like beauty to some extent is the cost of admission. So it's the like price of some kind of safety. It's also a lot of the time the price to even be seen. So if women in the academy are invisible or invisibilized because of structures of domination and like fucked up ideas about what counts as intelligence and not. So like, okay, so I have to be like kind of pretty in order just for you to recognize that I exist at all. But then that cost, like that price, ends up being the same justification of, well, then don't listen to this person at all. So it's the complete invisibility, and then suddenly you're not invisible anymore, but then you are rendered silent. The tactic that some women have, that it's like, okay, great, well, then we're just going to say that femininity bad, but I demand to be listened to. And just because those women like are minimalist in their gender presentation, they also tend to be like, in my experience, and my experience is only my experience, they tend to be white, upper middle class, thin, conventionally attractive women, or at least women that like clearly have had braces, like don't have acne. Like it's, there's all of this other stuff that they're still buying into. Like just because they can do, and this is like the TikTok trend, I guess, the clean beauty look and like seem like they're so sophisticated without doing the femininity in the wrong way, doesn't mean that they're also not doing femininity. It just means they're being assholes to everyone else. I think I can like be mean to people that are mean. I don't know. I was joking about them being ugly bitches. Not because I think that they're ugly, or like not because I buy into a economy of desire, but just because it's ugly as hell to be so nasty to other women who are doing their best to navigate like this like hell planet that we live on.
Yeah, imagine not being a girl's girl. I don't understand.
Yeah. I don't either. Imagine hating women.
Imagine hating women. Who hates women?
So many other women.
My experience of acceptance from like trans misogyny exempt people for the most part has been generally like some of my greatest allies, I feel like, have been she, her, who like own their femininity. Women, like there's an understanding, like you, Aurora, honestly, but like people that have an understanding of the pleasure of femininity and have like often are usually queer and have done some of like the inner work of grappling with that. Like maybe they have had a period of like trying to throw off their femininity, but then like also an understanding of like why it's pleasurable and like why you would do that. And I think that like some of the people that have been the worst to me are trans misogyny exempt non-binary people where they're not transitioning. So there's still like this attachment to womanhood as far as like womanhood as innocence or womanhood as innocence in opposition to men, especially like white womanhood. while at the same time, like, wanting to distance themselves from any of
the bad women.
Yeah, bad women, and just like from femininity in general. And obviously that's like not universally the case. There's tons of fabulous non-binary people of all kinds, tons of fabulous trans masks, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think it's interesting how some of my greatest ride or dies are just, you know, a good, solid she, her, cis woman with like really long nails. I don't know.
with a pound of makeup on their face. That's me. Like that,
lots of my best people are very much that type of femme. I think that's an interesting thing to observe. Around 3 years ago, so it was like near the beginning of the pandemic, I struggled all my life with work, but also just like kind of basic functioning in a lot of ways, which was always very confusing because I was extremely good at some things, very high like language skills, and I always like was a good conceptual thinker. But then when it came to like some pretty basic tasks that like most people considered very easy, I often really struggled with them, like filling out a sheet or like, you know, being able to like look at it and like see where the information is and then like take information here and like write it down. Little things like that have always been like pulling teeth for me. And so I went in and I got like my full mental health diagnosis, which, you know, is always a fraught thing. It's using things like IQ, which are histories of, you know, like inherently eugenics, like racist constructions, eugenics, fucked up. They like at least provide a framework within how like larger society is working around. Mm-hmm. And basically what they found out, quote unquote, is that, again, my language and conceptual thinking, very high. But then my working memory was extremely low. So my ability to like see a number, remember it, and write it down. Mm-hmm. And also my cognitive processing was on second percentile. So basically like how fast my brain works, especially on something that I am not like actively engaged in, I get better at something the more interested I am in it, like substantially. So like the more complex something gets, the faster I become at dealing with it. But when it comes to like opening a fridge and like finding the hot sauce, it takes much, much longer for me, for my brain to like find the thing that I'm looking for, to like actually see the things in there, especially if they're not there in the same places every single day. So like going shopping is kind of a nightmare for like groceries or whatever, because it just takes a lot longer. And so I kind of tied that into this overall like bimbo theory vibe. I'm just going to read this poem I wrote.
Yeah.
My official bimbo diagnosis, 28, already a transsexual for years, a scared animal even longer. They say in a room of 100, you are faster than one. Wow, she's smart, but you can hear the sound of dial-up. It's like this. There is a nothingness around a thought. A hungry nothing womb where my mind is, and sometimes it's so hungry that it rips apart the fetus of the thought in a red froth and makes it nothing too. Try and explain being prominently dreamy, a real symptom, to your boss. Capitalism does not have time to daydream. And yet still, poems are made. Here, a Catholic-blooded girl who soaked in shame and, like her ancestors, spun it erotic, bubblegum and cotton candy pink. If I have virtue, it is sloth. Like a poem, I take my time. So I was diagnosed with inattentive ADHD and sluggish cognitive tempo, which is a really fun list of things where it's like, oh yeah, the chances that you're going to be like unemployed and like houseless are like really high. And it's like, well, that's a bummer. Tying that into how things like executive function and things like splitting up types of tasks that I do in like power dynamics, I think a lot of that can be attached to the way that my brain works and why those things have been so attractive. Because if something comes from outward, if someone tells me to do something, I can just do it. And if I don't have to like fill out every single form in my life, but I also do like the majority of the cleaning, then that really like improves my life quite dramatically. And I think like one of the hardest things about neurodiversity is, it's often not the way that we think about intelligence, because intelligence is often thought of in a linear way. You know, we think about like small order tasks as being easy. And then as things get harder, you know, that's where like less and less people can be successful. And that's just not how brains work, because intelligence, you know, exists in all different types of ways, manifests in countless forms. And I think that this has compounded even further now with my experience with long COVID and POTS, where now I get like the brain fog has compounded with already my sluggish cognitive tempo and made things just, there are days where I just simply cannot process like even pretty basic shit. There are some days where I feel so bad that like even watching TV is like too much and I just kind of have to like lay down and listen to something. And that sort of like overwhelm has been something that, like everything I do in my life, I've like played with like eroticizing around like helplessness and around, you know, like, oh, I could like faint at random. It's started to, I think, for the first time, sort of shifted the way that I think about power. I've always wanted to give my power away. And I think that was also partially a defense against trans misogyny, because it's easier if you're like always the one acted upon, right? But as I have had like less power and as I have had more struggle to do more things, my desire for power and to be the actor within the limited capacity I have has actually like gotten a lot stronger. And so I'm like actively now playing on both sides of the slash and like actually being a dom in some situations. And I think it's interesting to think about how like something like a chronic illness or a lack of power can actually be the thing that like makes you seek out the power. And like there's some writing about that in Leather Folk. So like people have been thinking about this for a while, but that the way that we determine our roles and like think of ourselves in the world like really depends how our erotics and then our power relationships play out.
Can we talk a little bit about bimbos and femdoms? Because that seems like two contradictory categories, but what I'm seeing is that you're doing some category fuckery here.
Yeah, I don't know. You talk first. I think I need a moment from not talking.
Okay. So on the surface, the figure of the bimbo is like this hot, big-tittied airhead. Oh, but I think we've been talking about how like that's an artifice. It's an intentional aesthetic that does something more than just provide a pretty object to look at. Like it does something for the person that is the bimbo. Like it's them carefully navigating the circumstance they find themselves in. It's them finding pleasure in gender maximalism. It's also the rejection, I think, of minimalistic notions of gender that, again, only make us more docile bodies. And so docile body, it's a Foucauldian term. It means that we're ever more obedient to the structures that be while also being super productive. So my productivity, my capacity increases as I become ever more docile, ever more submissive. And so in embracing maximalism, the bimbo actually rejects passivity in a very, very interesting way, to use like very philosophical terms. I've been thinking a lot about how I communicate lately, and it is kind of all over the place now that I'm doing feminism more explicitly in my classes. So that's an aside. If the bimbo like isn't actually passive, isn't actually an airhead, they aren't just the submissive. I mean, of course they can be if that's what they want, but this also creates the possibility for doms, like femdoms, as not just existing for another, but as existing for themselves. And it immediately, like, it feels like, okay, bimbo, femdom, contradictory, but then you think about it like, oh, duh, those obviously go together very, very nicely.
All of those aesthetics very much arose from sex worker communities, like, and queer communities and trans community. And the idea that those things ever existed on their own as just this thing that was a performance for straight men, as opposed to a thing which the most marginalized used and created as a tool of survival and pleasure in the world dominated by those men, is very important distinction to make.
I also think that talking about aesthetics, that there are certain types of aesthetics that are literal flagging
So when I am playing with certain like feminine pieces of clothing or certain feminine makeup styles or hairstyles or jewelry, like I'm also expressing my connection or solidarity like with different groups of people that share those interests.
Yeah,
that's, no, absolutely. That's very crucial. Of course, like there's like a problem of appropriations. We see like the appropriation of sex worker chic, for example, or like white women love just like appropriating Black women's aesthetics. So if you're part of those communities, like you're signaling your solidarity with them and you're showing someone else that they can approach you. You're showing someone else that like you're there. And that's very important.
Well, it's a real thing that like a lot of women, like queer women, talk about who like want to be recognized as queer. And if they're femme, that like they're not perceived as femme. And like the thing is that that's because
they're not femme.
Yeah, exactly. When you're just like femme on the base level of just like you look like a feminine straight woman, you know, just like kind of normal. Like, yeah, you look like a straight woman. But when you perform, like when you are a femme and you're like really doing femininity in a specific way, like, yes, it's true. Straight people generally think I'm straight, but also gay people know that I'm gay.
Yeah.
Like, it is very obvious. And that's not something that I really have to worry about people picking up.
Yeah. And I would also say that there are ways to wear things or incorporate things into your aesthetic that expose the degree to which you are actually familiar with those things. So I'm not talking about like everyone, like there's a learning curve to put on makeup. I mean, like just things like there's that television show years ago at this point that was about like a dom in New York. And she wore an O-ring.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, there's just like little things like that where you can just kind of tell when someone is or is not comfortable with the kind of things that they're playing with. And of course, everyone should play and experience as much pleasure as possible. But if you don't think that you're being recognized as being the thing, it's maybe because you just aren't super familiar with the thing.
And it's like when anyone enters into anything, like there's usually an awkward stage where like you're going to wear things in a way that is not ideal. But what's absurd is how often people throw something on because it's like a counterculture, you know, edgy thing, but it's completely divorced from its meaning. This has always been the case that like celebrity culture, the way that fashion reaches it, like lots of the time it's coming from marginalized communities, and those looks and fashion like just take a while to be appropriated by the top. And like, that's not a new thing. That's not something that is probably going to change anytime soon, but it's good to know that it happens. It's very interesting to me how many trans people are into leather or kink or whatever. And I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. Like, I think that firstly, once you're trans, like you might as well follow through with other desires, because it's like, you know, a huge amount of the world thinks you're an irredeemable pervert anyway. So like, might as well like go all out. But also, I think that to come to the place of transition, there's an understanding of the way in which gender is in erotics, and the way that cis heteronormative sex operates is kind of this like artifice, and that sex can be this much more broad thing. And like, I think that just is inherently already more open to us. I think I found that people in leather communities generally, there's trans misogyny and transphobia there as there is everywhere else in the world. But I think that there's less than you would find in other queer space, because it's such a embracing of inner desire and erotics, as opposed to a lot of other queer space that is like very into politicizing and like condemning what is like proper or improper desire. Like those spaces, I think, even if they superficially are pro-trans women, I think it's very easy for them to turn on us because there's always this like inherent moralizing that's going on. And then the last thing on top of that, I think that to be disassociated from one's body in such a intense way, like I also think that like people who have experienced a lot of trauma, trans and not, I think are often more likely to be interested in BDSM, because it can be a way to reclaim some amount of power and also like your own body. For me, my body was like so distant from myself for my whole life, right? It, like I was so disassociated, and like sex was this thing that I like barely participated in. And then like these extreme states of embodiment, like pain, were very much a way of like reclaiming my body as a place that I can find pleasure in and occupy in a way that I was like unable to for so much of my life, you know?
So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between gender maximalism and embodiment. So how is it that maximizing gender, or like maybe even maximizing sex, affects one's embodiment? How did that impact your ability to feel less disassociated?
For this, I really like to go back to Susan Stryker's piece, Dungeon Intimacies, The Poetics of Transsexual Masochism. And so she's the trans scholar who wrote like Transgender History, which is a much more well-known, it's like the book. But this is like a very not well-known essay, but I think it's really important. And I talk about it in my essay, my official bimbo diagnosis. So I'll read a part that quotes from it. So Susan Stryker writes in Dungeon Intimacies that there are those who say that magic is the art and science of creating change in accordance with the will. Transsexual body modification is one such practice. Then me. Transformation, an obsession of mine since I was a young child that made me feel strange, was the thing I finally pursued with transition. So repressed and socially maligned that the desire for it must be overflowing for it to be able to finally push you over the edge to undertake. Through the manifold transformation of the hormonal redirecting of my body chemistry, the physical ripping open and restrictings of surgery, and the experience of having new narratives brought upon me to explain me as I was perceived anew, began to bring myself closer to a sort of unity, my body and mind no longer experienced as completely individual subjects. Stryker thinks of BDSM first within the context of the liminal space of dungeon play party, and later as a practice generally, as a technology for the production of transgendered embodiment, a mechanism for dismembering and disarticulating received patterns of identification, affect, sensation, and appearance, and for reconfiguring, coordinating, and remapping them in bodily space. So in this way, my transition has not been so dissimilar from my practice as a BDSM submissive, or maybe more accurately, my practice as a BDSM submissive could be seen as another aspect of my transition, another way to be more myself. So I think the way that we experience pleasure through gender play, and also Tori Peters in her book Detransition Baby like talks about this in a really lovely way, that like cis people are also constantly performing gender in these ways that they get pleasure from, but they're not allowed to say that that's what they're doing because they've naturalized it, but they're constantly performing, you know, either like homoeroticism, either when it's like in the frat party or in the essential oils selling, or in, you know, like the heterosexual
I can just think of sports guys like spanking each other. A lot of spanking happens in male sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's something specifically about the space that BDSM can create where there's a kind of like ripping open of narrative thread. So you're not quite as bound in as you are in outside spaces. I mean, I know certainly for me, like it helped. The thing that helped me get to the point where I was able to transition in the first place was moving abroad and living abroad for several years away from everyone I knew. And I think that like the dungeon and the play space can be a similar kind of space for people where they can kind of try on aspects of themselves that are foreign or maybe even like taboo to themselves, because it's a very different form of space. You're not just coming to each other as these like fully formed identities as you would when you're like dating someone, you know, where you already have this predefined dance that you're doing with the other person. And I think that's really how what I see like gender maximalism is, this really taking gender and all of its trappings that obviously have very fraught and often oppressive origins, but like recognizing how they can be sites of pleasure for us and reclaiming them and playing with them and kicking them up to 100, as opposed to what cis heteronormativity does is it like maintains that modality, like you said, of like being typically feminine, you know, having giant diamonds on your fingers, living a cis heteronormative lifestyle. But then it's like, oh, but like I, you know, I don't have like a pound of makeup on my face. So, you know, better than the bimbo, better than the sex worker, better than the transsexual.
Mm-hmm. I'm not frivolous. I'm serious.
You know, even if you're in the middle, even if what you like is not one or the other, even if you feel somewhere in between or somewhere totally different. The point is an embrace of those like erotics of self-expression, and also like a commitment to the performance of erotics for like one another and like in community. Whereas I think one of the things, you know, like we talked about with lots of what especially like cishet manhood is about the performance of not performing. But even as we said with like cishet womanhood, you definitely like don't want to look like you're performing too much, right? Because then that means that you can be dismissed and like taken less seriously.
Lots of different ways to be a pick me, turns out. It's the double bind.
The double bind. So that idea of the dungeon or play as this like space of trans, in parentheses, gender embodiment, that place where there can be like this loosening up of those narrative threads so that we can change how those symbols and roles that we play with one another, those can really open new pathways to new ways of understanding ourselves, new ways of expressing ourselves, reveal things that we've repressed about our own selves that like come forward and then maybe make us change how we are in a broader sense, which I, again, is I think why it's actually quite a common thing for a lot of trans people to have some sort of experience before they transition where the erotic space allows them to get to the point where like they're expressing that thing. I think that's something we should all fully embrace, and also just know that that's not something that's unique to trans people. Everyone's doing it. Everyone's playing with gender, but we should commit to the bit and really, really take it to its conclusion, which is why, you know, you can tell that a femme is gay because, you know,
you know,
they're doing femme.
Should we move on to confessions?
Yeah, let's move on to confessions.
But we didn't just do normal confessions.
Yeah. So this time we didn't ask for normal confessions. We just asked, what does gender maximalism mean to you? And so gender maximalism, you know, I've talked about it a few times on Instagram and some other things. It's not something that is like super present. So like some people didn't know what it was, but also just people kind of intuited what it was to them. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're going to read those out for you.
Okay. So I'll go first. Butch/femme is a great starting framework. High femmes crafting a gender and just existing in it.
Lip fillers and testosterone.
I'm taking HRT long enough to let the quote permanent unquote effects come in without planning for top surgery, and then plan to get off HRT around 3 to 5 years and let my fat redistribute back. I want all of the secondary sex characteristics.
Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Being purposefully clocky, cartoonish renditions of gender aesthetics. Chaos.
I love that. Performing gender to the point of satire.
Collecting genders like Pokemon. Seriously. Experiencing many, expressing them all.
Bold, evolved. Lots of O's and a little crying face.
It means that I am not afraid to take up as much space as I want, both physically and in your line of sight. If you don't like it, move and look elsewhere.
Reveling in the extremes of gender expression, using stereotypes as a source of joy and play.
Layering myself in so many gendered symbols, people are unable to parse what the fuck is going on.
Gender as performance, exclamation point, archetypes, exclamation point, being the most, because why not, exclamation point, and then comfort, exclamation point.
Full commitment to the bit.
Not really sure, but at least for me, it's not ignoring that I feel most at home in, quote, gender stereotypes, unquote.
The non-binary people expect from me is the absence of not a boy, not a girl, no tits, skinny. But I want it all. I want to be so much. I want signifiers from both that don't make sense. I want to be hard to swallow.
Can't be reclaiming and perverting of gendered aesthetics, the opposite of gender neutral.
Customizing my meat vessel in any way I can to make cis people uncomfortable while I thrive.
Meat vessel. Minimalist. Formless, ethereal, neutrals, normcore, earthy, billowy, monochrome, matte. Maximalist. Color, problem patterns, body hair, lots of hair, extreme curves and curls, posture. The only gender binary that is relevant at this point is gender maximalist and gender minimalist.
I am gender maximalism. I think realizing that cishets are on a different planet altogether and creating my own community and expression.
Going so hard into a gendered thing that it makes the gender police uncomfortable.
I don't know, but I'm hot and I feel hot and people like kissing me.
Okay.
All right. We didn't get to the mall because there's a gazillion, but thank you all so much for submitting your thoughts and keep an eye out on our Instagrams for when we do ask questions if you would like your answers to be featured on the show.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being part of our lovely little flock. And where can people go if they want to support the show?
Yeah, so you can go to www.patreon.com/drunkchurch and sign up at any level tier. You get different things at different tiers, and we're in the process of revamping some of those because we've been having technical difficulties with our host. We're an entirely independent show. We don't have ads or anything. And so it's you guys that support us in those ways that really keep this thing going for mm-hmm. us. Also, another great way to support us is to, if you like something we do, to share it with your friends. Tell people about an episode that you like and just keep coming back to listen.
God bless everyone.
God bless.
Bless you for being an angel. Just when it seemed that heaven was not for me. Bless you for building a new dream. Just when my old dream crumbled so helplessly. In that vine-covered chapel on the hill, your face was a hymn that lingers still. So bless you, my darling, my angel. Heaven is mine and life is divine with you.
Bless you, darling, for being an angel. Just when it seemed that heaven was not for me. Bless you for building a new dream. Just when my old dream crumbled so helplessly.
In that vine-covered chapel on the hill, your face was a hymn that lingers still. So bless you, my darling, my angel. Heaven is mine.